The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Could your stock picking skills beat the market this year? In this week's FT Money Show podcast, we'll be revealing the results of our 2019 contest between readers and FT journalists and giving you all the details of how to enter this year's competition. January's nearly over, but you still have another 11 months to make good on your New Year's resolutions. If you had resolved to get a pay rise or sort out your company pension this year, then keep listening as expert help is at hand. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's podcast about personal finance and investing. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, bringing you all of this week's money news. Now, given the rip-roaring success of passive funds, the past few years have not been kind to stock pickers. But whilst we might adopt a more sedate approach to long-term investing in our day-to-day financial lives, FT journalists have long enjoyed the newspaper's annual fantasy stock-picking contest to spice up their investment choices. Well, thank goodness there was no actual money at stake, as the results are in, and this year plenty of our writers came a cropper. Now, the rules of our contest are simple. You have to pick 5 shares, that's the hardest part, and decide whether you're going long, i.e. betting the shares will rise, or going short, betting that the shares will fall between now and the 31st of December. And then, of course, wait for a year to be humiliated by the intern. But overall, FT readers fared much better than we did, because for the first time in 2019, we opened up the competition and around 700 of you made an entry and did remarkably well. Our resident markets guru, Robert Smith, is here to reveal all of the results. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks for having me on, Claire.
Well, thanks for organising the contest. But I mean, let's start by saying at the outset, investing with a one-year time horizon and trying to shoot the lights out, which is what you need to do in competitions like this, this is not something that sensible investors should try and do with their everyday portfolio.
No, of course not. Like, single stock investing for anything more than fund money is a terrible idea. It's a bit like going down William Hill. I wouldn't advise that. Low-cost tracker funds are generally the way to go. And as like the Neil Woodford example shows, if you're going to use an active manager, do research on who he is and what he's investing in. But the reason we do this is because it's fun. It's a bit like Monopoly. It's trying to beat the market in a safe setting. And like, the only loss here is your pride.
Well, exactly. And it's a good way of learning about investing as well. I've been encouraging my stepchildren to enter. Also, FT schools are lighting a fire underneath it. So when we ask people to enter this competition a year ago, markets were obviously a much different place to where they are now. We'd had a terrible final quarter, the tech stocks were in the doldrums, and there were a lot of companies that were kind of teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. So the choices that people made then may be a bit easier to make than they are now.
Yeah, I think particularly for the FT writers, there at the end of 2018, when they were making their choices last time around, there was a massive some people called it the tech wreck.
Oh, I remember that one.
These snappy little phrases. But a lot of technology companies that people who said were overvalued were getting hammered. And, you know, all these fears that, the second.com bubble is bursting. But it ended up just being a sort of brief moment of panic. And then large tech companies did incredibly well last year. So some of our FT writers who got suckered into shorting them got their faces ripped off, as we like to say in the market. So like Apple rallied 86% last year.
86%.
Yeah, it's actually up massively today as well because they've shot the lights out on iPhone orders and that sort of thing. So yeah, anyone short Apple did very badly in our contest last year. But on the flip side, the best single stock pick from a journalist was Snap, which is the company that makes the Snapchat app, which again has a very weak balance sheet. A year ago, looked very precarious, but a few improvements in their operations, a lot more optimism about tech, and it rallied, I think, nearly 200% last year. So, yeah, there were some writers who did well out of seeing value in these tech companies and other writers who got suckered into shorting them.
Now, the other big trend was that the journalists were much more likely to short companies overall than the readers. And some of those short picks worked out quite well, just not the tech ones.
Yeah, I mean, look, journalists are sort of maladjusted, negative people. So I don't think it's any surprise that we like shorting things for fun. I should stress, none of us short things in the real world. But yeah, there were quite a few UK companies with very obviously damaged balance sheets and business models, which were shorted by multiple journalists. So Debenhams is one example. Now, Debenhams still exists on the high street. It hasn't gone out of business, but its shares have been wiped out. The same is true of Interserve, which is a contractor in a very similar business model to Carillion, which some of our listeners might know caused the scandal a couple of years ago.
High debt levels, of course.
Exactly.
Big feature in both of those
exactly.
collapses.
So Interserve still exists as a business, but the shareholders got wiped out. Thomas Cook, however, doesn't exist as a business anymore. Its shareholders got wiped out and the business has been wound down. So all three of those companies were shorted by multiple FT journalists.
And readers,
exactly. So look, these were companies with very visible issues. It didn't mean they were definitely going to fail, but people could see problems coming down the track.
And obviously a lot of these short positions made by some people, myself, were doing fairly well throughout the year. And then the Boris bounce came along and picked up lots of these kind of struggling UK companies. So we ended the year not doing as well as we might have hoped.
Yeah. There were definitely some UK focused shorts that sort of got undone by the Boris optimism at the end of the year. And look, it's not just the UK, that sort of game of two halves thing with short selling. Like, the most popular short from our readers and a common short from our writers was Tesla.
Mm.
Halfway through the year, stock price was down nearly 50%. Amazingly, it ended the year significantly up, which to claw your way back and then end the year up is sort of kind of crazy. So yeah, it's always fun as you do the sort of highs and lows as the year plays out of following how your stocks are doing is always fun. And there's often extreme examples.
Absolutely. And, you know, it also emphasizes the education aspect to doing this because you're going to give us quite regular updates throughout the year on where things are going. And we really hope that younger readers in particular will, you know, this will be a way that they can get to learn more about how the markets work. Now, the readers who did really well, some of them are coming into the office in a couple of weeks' time to lord it over us. They were really impressive because they, in general, all went long and mm-hmm. on a variety of little-known companies. It's quite easy to pick a company that's in trouble and go short and benefit from that. But the ones who go long, I tip my hat off because there were some astonishing success stories.
Yeah, so the thing about short selling is the most you can make shorting a stock is 100%. Because if you think about it, if the company collapses, then you lose all your money. But if you bet against it, you make all your money. But the most you can make is 100% of the value of the company, if that makes sense. So you can only make 100%. But obviously, if you bet on a really good company, your returns are like limitless, right? If you bought Apple stock in the 80s, the stock is up tens of thousands of percent now, right? So the readers who did well tended to have picked one really good sort of lottery ticket stock, shall we say, that they went long. And the reader who won overall was Neil Abbott, and he works in drug registration for a large pharmaceutical company. So you might be able to guess what stocks he picked.
Did he picked what he knew?
Yeah, he picked what he knew. And he picked a bunch of speculative pharma stocks. And one of them went up nearly 700%. But the thing worth noting is that his overall return was, I think, around 100%. And that's because all the other four, like, absolutely bombed. And Neil, when he was explaining his picks, he was very open about this. He said, look, the thing about pharma is you either lose all your money or you make a load of money. He was very open about this, that it's a gamble, basically. So he had, think about it this way, he had five lottery tickets, four of them didn't pay out and one of them did, and he did quite well.
And then the reader who came in second place, he had a much more diverse basket of companies.
Yeah, so our reader who came in second place, Matthew Grint, he actually had what I'd call more of a hedge fund strategy. So the classic hedge fund strategy is what we call long-short investing. When it comes to the stock market, that is, hedge funds do all different types of things. But when it comes to the stock market, and that is, they try and bet on big winners, and they also try and short companies that they think they'll do badly. Hedge funds can do a lot more sophisticated things than typical fund managers. But yeah, Matthew Grint could make quite a good hedge fund manager from the looks of things. He shorted Debenhams and that paid off 100%. But he also went long Amazon, which is one of these tech companies that did fantastically well last year. So he had a good mix of shorts that did very well and long positions that did very well.
So finally, I have to say, which FT writer came top? Wasn't me, wasn't you?
Yeah, so it's a good friend of mine, Miles Johnson, who actually, I think he devised this competition originally years ago.
Yeah.
And then he
wanted to show off.
Exactly. Yeah. I should say the year before he did very badly, but he did very well this year. He notched up 47% returns. He's now our REM bureau chief, as I said. Miles, again, is a kind of wannabe hedge fund manager. Sorry, Miles. So he followed that kind of strategy. He shorted Thomas Cook, again, 100% return there. But he also had some very good long picks. He went long a company called Altice USA, which is a cable company, which he smartly thought was drastically undervalued. So Miles had a very good mix of different ideas in his portfolio that played out very well.
Brilliant. So for people who are listening thinking, right, okay, five stocks, long or short, I can do this. There is a deadline, I have to say. You need to get it done before the end of the weekend. 3rd of February is the cutoff, so we need your entry by midnight on Sunday the 2nd. So as listeners are working out what they're going to pick for their five stocks, long or short, under a week left to enter the contest online. We need your entries in by midnight on Sunday, the 2nd of February. Obviously, all the journalists have got to do it too. What kind of things are running through your mind, Robert, as you weigh up what to pick?
Yeah, so I have to be honest, Claire, this is the first year where I don't have any big, screaming, obvious ideas in my head. And I have a couple of days left to think about it. But the thing we should note is that our readers are restricted to certain large stock markets, which will make it a lot easier for us to track.
Yes, because one of the reasons we're launching it so late this year, I should say, is because we kind of offered every stock in the world last year, and it was just absolutely impossible to find a spreadsheet big enough to track all of those markets, which is a shame. And we will try and work on including more markets next year, but for now, there's still 3,000 stocks on there.
Yeah, it still encompasses like a lot. There's a lot you can play with there. I think what I always find interesting personally is when people have big thematic sort of structural ideas behind their picks. And I think this is why this contest is useful from an education perspective, thinking about how changes in society might affect market prices. And the reason I bring that up is because the most interesting FT writer entry I've had so far, they're still trickling in, is someone who's shorting all US private healthcare companies because he thinks that Bernie Sanders will win the presidency and bring in healthcare for all in the US. And it's going to be very bad for people who profit from healthcare.
Okay. So, I mean, that's obviously a very high conviction, one theme thing. I mean, what I will be looking at over the weekend as I'm doing my entry is, I think we're going to get more sterling weakness ahead in the UK, in the UK's market I know best. Will that produce any more takeover prospects? Like, we've seen some really big ones that have happened this year. So for my long picks, I think that's a theme that I will try and exploit. And dare I say, I might get a copy of the Investor's Chronicle. Have a little look, see what Simon Thompson is recommending in his bargain portfolio. But if you want to enter, then get online now. We've made a link. It's free to do so. ft.com/stockpick2020. That's ft.com/stockpick2020. We'll also be tweeting that out all over the weekend from our main Twitter account at FT Money. So you can follow that for the link to both the article and the competition. And Robert, you'll be coming back regularly throughout the year to give us updates on what's been happening and how people are doing.
I'm looking forward to that greatly. Thanks.
Well, thanks very much there to Robert Smith, the FT's capital markets correspondent. That link again, ft.com/stockpick2020. And you can read Robert's full article, Are You a Champion Stock Picker? With all of the rules explained now on ft.com/money. Good luck. Getting a pay rise and sorting out your company pension. If you are a listener of the Money Show podcast, then these two things are likely to be top of your financial to-do list in 2020. But how should you go about ticking them off? Well, joining me to discuss is the FT's working careers editor, Isabel Berwick, and FT Money's Emma Adjuman. Welcome both.
Thank you.
Hey.
So, Isabel, would you like a pay rise?
Yes, I would, Claire.
Well, that was easy, wasn't it? But in practice, your boss coming up to you and saying, would you like a pay rise, hardly ever happens. And we have to be the ones who are doing the asking. But I mean, how on earth do you ask a question like that?
I think the first thing I would say is, don't just go in and ask it. Do your prep beforehand and pick your moment. And the key things to get are data, which you can get internally from colleagues. It's a difficult ask. But if you can ask colleagues how much they earn, find someone who does a similar job, take them out for a coffee, raise the subject. The only thing that's holding you back is your own insecurity. And I think we need to get over this, because who's benefiting from us not sharing our salaries? It's our employers. And it's a really key thing. I think this is going to be a really key trend in 2020, salary transparency. And when you've got hold of that data and look outside, see, have a look at salary surveys, ask what friends in similar occupations are doing. When you've got that data, pick your moment to ask. Don't go and attack your boss when their door's shut and they're shouting at someone on the phone.
I like it. Good. And, you know, there's so much more data available now as well on websites like Glassdoor, which I have to confess wasn't one I'd heard of until you mentioned it at an event we were at last week.
Glassdoor. And also, for some people use the tactic of going out and getting an alternative job offer. It's a fairly high risk tactic, but it will help you to leverage in some cases. So that's an increasingly common tactic, and you might find that you like the job that you're being offered more than one you're currently in.
But for most people, being focused on growing skills and experience in the workplace in the hope that a growing pay packet will follow could be an effective strategy.
I'm not sure it will be an immediately effective strategy, but it's a great thing to do for the long term. If we think about our careers, not the sort of straight lines going upwards, you know, your career might look like it's stalling for a bit, but actually you're getting those extra skills and experience. You're using your employer's resources to help you develop. And then when the time is right, you either ask for a pay rise or move to a new position, either internally or externally. I think playing the long game with pay and experience is a really good tactic.
Well, we'll come back more to some specifics on pay in a minute. But Emma, let's turn to company pensions now, which are, after all, a key part of our pay. What are the key pieces of information that every worker needs to know about their company scheme?
You're right, Claire. I mean, the problem is that lots of people are very unengaged with their pension, but it's a huge part of what the employer offers you in terms of benefits. So I'd say the two things that people really need to understand. Firstly, what's the kind of matching levels that your employer is going to put into your pension? Because different companies are sort of more or less generous. Some will actually sort of match everything that you put in. Some might double match. You know, if you actually kind of quadruple, I mean, there's lots of different models out there.
So it's usually expressed as a percentage of salary. So you would put in, say, 3% of your gross pay and the employer would match that with 3%, or maybe double match, as you say, with 6%. But every company is different.
Exactly. And so the key thing really is to understand what your company is offering. And maybe that might be something you might want to bring up as early as a job interview.
Well, yes. You know? Isabel, you were nodding furiously.
I think pensions are absolutely key. And I wish people thought about them more when they're thinking about their total remuneration. if you've got an employer with a generous pension, that's a huge thing. A double match or triple match is something you should really look for, I would guess.
Yeah. But what more do you think employers and the pensions industry at large could do to get people to engage with their pensions? Because a lot of people that we met at an event that we did last week, me and Isabel, were kind of like, I know I need to know about pensions, but yeah. You know, it's just not very accessible.
It really isn't. And I think a lot of the issues to do with communication. You know, I've been at an event where somebody called the retirement, you know, your 40-year holiday, if you think of that as what you're trying to save up to whilst you're working, it might make you think, oh, well, actually, I want to make sure I've got enough money to survive my 40-year holiday, potentially.
Well, yeah, in my case, probably 10 and a half year holiday.
Well, there you are. You know, this is the thing. So I think that there's a real sort of opportunity for companies and the industry to actually be better at explaining the value of pensions and getting people to be more engaged with that.
And the kind of woolly language that you see in the annual statements. But I mean, Isabel, pay and pensions are especially important topics for women because we've all heard of the gender pay gap, of course, but experts have also coined the term the gender pensions gap because women's pensions are so much smaller than men's at retirement. What are the key lessons here for you?
I think certainly from my own experience, I worked part-time for 18 years. That's a huge gap in my pension. And I made alternative investments during that time. Not enough, but I think there's a lot more thinking we could be doing around advising women on what they could be doing if they're not working full time, if they're not getting a huge amount into their pensions. And also, at the same time, you have to be saving for your children's education. So there's a lot of calls on your money as a woman. And I'd like to see some structural change in employers to offer more benefits to women who are working part-time, for example, when their children are small, or who have caring duties that can help them build up their pension pots.
And anecdotally, I've talked to lots of friends who are working part-time, and I often ask them, have you ever asked for a pay rise as a part-time worker? And many of them say, no, I haven't, just because they're so grateful to have the ability to work part-time. They kind of feel that asking for more money is pushing it. But you would say, go for it.
I would say go for it, although I never did that myself. And I think it's a really hard thing to do. And I applaud people who do it. And I applaud employers who are encouraging part-time women to come forward and to be promoted, because I think that's the single key thing, promoting women who are working part-time or in job shares and showing that you can advance in your career while you've also got other responsibilities.
And Emma, gender pensions gap, obviously a key problem. We do write about it quite a lot in FT Money. What more do you think could be done to narrow it?
Well, you know, I think that the issue, again, the sort of I was raising about communication and women's understanding as well, because if you actually start speaking to maybe younger women from the time before they might be starting to have families about the importance of starting to think about saving now or what they're going to do if they decide to come back as part-time, that actually starts getting women to think about it. And Isabel's right, you know, I do think that employers also should be sort of doing more to help women maybe before they get into that situation.
Well, thanks very much there to the FT's Isabel Berwick and FT Money's Emma Ajuman. We will be writing more about both of these topics in FT Money in the coming weeks, but you can check out articles on both on our website now at ft.com/money. Well, that's it for The Money Show this week. We will be back next week, but if you wish to get in contact with us before then, you can email the team money@ft.com or follow us on Twitter @ftmoney. The podcast was produced in London by Lucy Warwick Ching. We'll be back next week at the usual time. Goodbye.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, And how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.